I'd have gone a bit overboard with the unrealistically perfect abdominal muscles leading down into the feline half. It was just as it had appeared from a distance, a statue of something like a centaur, but with the lower half of a lion instead of a horse.
"Is that even a real creature?" asked Julian.
Stacy hopped down off the horse and approached the statue.
"It's beautiful."
Julian followed her gaze to its abs.
"It's an adequate piece of sculpting."
He told himself it was silly to feel jealous of a statue, especially a statue of a monster. But even putting that aside, he couldn't help but take issue with the sculptor's decision to include a belt around the creature's waist with a scabbarded dagger. Either go for the gusto and put a weapon in its hand for an action pose, or don't include the weapon at all.
"Why would someone abandon such a magnificent work of art out here in the desert?"
Stacy's gushing did little to help Julian get a grip for his irrational feelings.
"Well, maybe it fell off the crescent shadow. It could have been a gaudy decoration outside of a casino or something."
Stacy shook her head.
"There's no way it would have survived the fall in such good condition. Look at how detailed it is."
She leaned in to inspect it more closely.
"Look at the hair. Some of it looks to have been carved into individual follicles."
Julian had a sudden revelation.
"I know what this is."
He walked wide around the statue, appreciating the detail in the lion fur, the back muscles of the human-like torso, and the finely detailed hair which hung down past the shoulders.
"Holy shit! What is it?"
asked Stacy, sounding a little concerned.
"What did you figure out?"
"This is no statue. I mean, it is, but those individual hair follicles weren't chiseled. They were real."
"I don't quite follow you."
"This game borrows a lot from ancient mythologies. Think Medusa."
Stacy smiled.
"I think you've got your mythologies mixed up. Medusa wasn't a lion person. She was the lady with the snakes for hair."
"That's right," said Julian. "And what happened to people who looked at her?"
"They turned to..."
Stacy gasped and gawked up at the statue.
"No fucking way."
Julian came around to meet her at the front.
"What else could it be? It's just like you said. That's way too finely detailed to have been the work of even a master sculptor."
Stacy scanned the horizon in every direction.
"Does that mean Medusa is roaming around here in the desert?"
"Not necessarily. She's just the first thing that came to mind. I'm sure there are other kinds of creatures in this game that can turn people to stone. In fact, it's probably safe to rule out Medusa."
"Why is that?"
"Well, look at his posture, all proud and confident. Not a worry in the world. Medusa was supposed to be horrifying to look at. He should be more like this."
Julian made his best horrified face while raising his arms to shield his eyes and stood completely still for a second.
"Maybe she was wearing a hood or a mask or something and caught him off guard."
Stacy pulled her own hood over her head, keeping her face hidden in its shadow and sashayed toward Julian.
"Hey there, big boy. What's a fine-looking lion man monster thing like you dueling all alone out here in the desert?"
She suddenly pulled back her hood, exposing her face, and hissed at him. Julian jumped, then shrugged.
"I suppose that it could have gone down like that."
He looked back up at the poor bastard's petrified face. Something was off about it, but he couldn't quite put his finger on what.
"Was it smirking like that just a moment ago?"
Stacy eyed the statue's face.
I don't know. It seems like I would have..."
"Good afternoon, travelers,"
said the statue.
"Wow!"
cried Stacy, her right fist flying toward its face. The creature, obviously not a statue, caught Stacy by the wrist with one hand and gently placed the other over her fist. Its skin, fur, and hair changed right before their eyes. The stone color and texture gave way to yellow fur, dark bronze skin, and hair as black as ink. He looked into Stacy's eyes as he brought her hand to his lips to kiss it.
"The desert is home to many dangerous beasts, but every so often one may find a flower of immeasurable beauty."
"Laying it on kind of thick there, buddy. I don't know what kind of woman you think a ham-fisted lion like that works on, but Stacy..."
"Well, ain't you a charmer?"
said Stacy, pulling her hand back, but not quite out of the lion man monster thing's grip.
"What's your name?"
"I am Strovgar, and who might I have the pleasure of addressing?"
"My name is Stacy. Now, this is my friend, Jew..."
"Stacy,"
said Strovgar.
"The angels weep. It's such a beautiful sound."
Stacy waved.
"Oh, stop."
"You have traveled far and are weary. Stay with me for a time, so that we may enjoy the pleasure of each other's company."
"Sorry," said Julian. "We'd love to, but we got lost, and we're not sufficiently equipped to be traveling in the desert. We can't afford to waste any more."
"Oh, come on, Julian." Stacy looked at him and tilted her head. "One more hour isn't going to make that big a difference."
"One more hour?"
"Tell your sister she needn't worry,"
Strafgar said to Stacy,
"for you are not far from the village of Tamar."
"Hey," said Julian, "I'm not her sister. I'm a man."
Strafgar spared Julian a brief glance up and down.
"A thousand apologies, Julia."
"Julian!"
"I was fooled by your delicate body and pretty dress."
"These are sorcerer robes?"
Julian hoped that stressing the word sorcerer might be perceived as a warning, but hearing himself say it aloud made him feel like a huge dork. Change the subject.
And what are you exactly? I'm not familiar with your, species."
"I am a Lamia."
"Oh," said Julian. "Cool."
"And this man?"
Strafgar glanced Julian up and down again, as if to concede that Julian barely passed the technical definition of the word, then turned his attention back to Stacy.
"He is your lover?"
Stacy shrugged. "We're taking it kind of slow."
"He does not meet your womanly needs, yes?"
"Oh, that's one way of saying it."
"Stacy,"
said Julian. "It's nothing to be ashamed of, Julian. We'll get there."
"That's not the point. We don't know this guy. You don't have to go blurting out our private sexual issues to a complete stranger."
"Forgive me for intruding,"
said Strafgar.
"But it is I who blurted out your issues. They are no secret to me, you see."
"Why, are you telepathic or something?"
Strafgar laughed.
"Oh, alas, I am not. But I have traveled far and wide and have known many elves. You have no hunger for the carnal pleasures, and you have a penis like a little girl."
He rolled over onto his side, planting his elbow in the sand and propping up his head with his hand. He raised his left hind leg, exposing his junk. His penis looked like Julian's forearm, and his smooth scrotum looked like it was holding two baked potatoes.
"Whoa!"
Julian shielded his eyes.
"That's not really a probe."
"It would give me immense pleasure,"
Strafgar said to Stacy.
"If you would rub my genitals until I ejaculate."
Julian gasped. The nerve of this mother. Stacy licked her lips. "That sounds like a good time."
"What?"
Was she really that starved for sex? Was she some kind of nympho? Strafgar turned and locked eyes with Julian.
"Then your friend can lap up my seed like a dog."
A wave of relief washed over Julian. He'd been thinking of himself as a third wheel. It was thoughtful of Strafgar to include him in his... Wait, no, something is wrong here. Did he just ask me to... Julian stepped forward and pulled Stacy back by the shoulders just before her hands took hold of Strafgar's slowly erecting dong. For his effort, he got a harsh glare and an even harsher elbow in the gut. "This jealousy thing is getting out of control," she said, as Julian fell on his ass in the sand, trying to start breathing again. "I'm a grown woman, and I can make my own choices. You had your chance, and you blew it."
"No!"
wheezed Julian when he had enough breath.
"He's got you under a spell."
Stacy shook her head. "You're pathetic." She headed back to Strafgar, whose penis was now fully erect. It was red, pointed at the end, and covered in backward-facing barbs. Strafgar shrugged and grinned at Julian.
"How does this saying go? Appreciate what battles you win, for you cannot win them all."
Julian wasn't sure if he was saying that Julian shouldn't feel too bad about the fact that Stacy was about to jerk him off, or that he wasn't harboring any hard feelings about Julian not wanting to lap up his seed like a dog.
"Please, Stacy, listen to me. He's inside your head. He was in mine, too. You don't want to..."
howled Strafgar. It sent a chill up Julian's spine, for there was only one thing that could cause a creature to make that sound. Julian looked from Strafgar's horror-stricken face to his impressively large nutsack and found that, sure enough, Stacy was pulling her dagger out of the ladder. He cringed and pressed his legs tightly together. Strafgar rolled over, winced as he got to his feet, and reached for his dagger. All his hand met was an empty sheath. Stacy, on the other hand, was now armed with two daggers. Julian recognized one as the dagger she kept in her boot.
its straight thin blade dripped with testicle blood. The other dagger was a little on the flamboyant side for a rogue. Its larger curved blade was just about the same size and shape as Strovgar's sheath.
"Julian,"
she said, flicking the small dagger down into the sand at his feet. Now that she had blown her cover with a sneak attack, there wasn't much point in being roguish. Between the two of them, she was the stronger fighter, and therefore better suited to wield the bigger blade. Julian picked up the dagger, careful not to let any of the blood touch his fingers.
"You will pay for your deception, human whore,"
said Strovgar. Stacy balked at him.
"You literally just used magic to make me jerk you off, and I'm the deceptive whore?"
Strovgar narrowed his eyes and grinned.
"Your defiance only makes me crave you more. My wound shall heal, but once I've finished having my pleasure with you, I shall leave you with pain that will never go away."
Julian shivered, thinking about those barbs on its dick.
"You better go away," said Stacy, "or I'll finish what I started."
"Save your meaningless threats for the little elf bitch."
Julian threw up his hands.
"What the fuck, man?"
"Come on over here and see how meaningless my threats are," said Stacy. "I'll be doing a favor to every woman who crosses your path."
Strovgar gave her a slight bow.
"Very well. If it is a fight your heart desires, a fight it shall have."
"Come on, man," said Julian. "She's letting you off easy. We've got weapons. You don't. Just go away and nobody has to get hurt."
"You needn't be afraid, little girl. It would still give me pleasure for you to watch, so I shall only cripple you."
As if being a rapist wasn't bad enough, he was being a real prick about the whole thing. Julian shrugged.
"Have it your way, asshole. Bring it on. Oh, shit."
7 more Strovgars appeared, all standing side by side, whichever one of them was the original Strovgar, mimicking his movements precisely. It was like Riverdance, except with Lion Man rape monsters bleeding from the nuts. All 8 Strovgars pounced simultaneously at Stacy, blurring and changing positions. Stacy blocked their human-like arms, but one of their forepaws raked its claws across her belly, tearing through her clothes and into her skin. She sliced Strovgar's dagger down hard on one of them, revealing the extra 7 to be mere illusions as it winked out of existence.
"Stacy," said Julian, "are you okay?"
Stacy backed up and readied herself for another attack.
"I'm fine. He fights like a kitten."
Strovgar let out an inarticulate roar as he and his 6 remaining backup dancers lunged at Stacy again. Julian wondered if what Stacy said had pissed him off because it was emasculating or because it was racist. She rolled under him as he leaped at her and was back on her feet before he turned around. She glared at Julian.
"Go around the other side and start stabbing away the fake ones. Keep them between us, and I'll get my sneak attack bonuses."
Julian was impressed. Stacy was really getting a handle on the nuts and bolts of the game a lot faster than he had. It must have had something to do with her high intelligence score.
"Stop flapping your lips, walking cocksleeve,"
said 7 Strovgars.
"Your nonsensical words make my ears hurt."
"You know what?"
said Julian, once he got into position on the other side of him. He waited briefly for a what that didn't come. Strovgar didn't even turn around or acknowledge him. Nevertheless, Julian answered the question.
"Fuck you!"
He held Stacy's dagger high and ran at one of the Strovgars, hoping it was an illusory one. It wasn't. Julian caught a rear paw in the gut that threw him back. He didn't think he was injured, but he also failed to get in a stab. Stacy, on the other hand, hacked the shit out of one of the illusory Strovgars. If that had been the real one, he would have been in some serious shit. Instead, there was just one fewer image. Strovgar seethed with rage as he continued to swipe at Stacy, and she continued to duck, weave, and jump out of the way. She looked pretty pleased with herself until one of his fists connected with her face.
"Ha!"
said Strovgar. Stacy wiped a drop of blood from under her nose, then looked at her finger.
"You son of a..."
"Hell!"
said Julian, annoyed that he was still being ignored, and wishing he had a better battle cry. He brought down Stacy's dagger hard on Lion Ass and was shocked when his hand failed to swipe right through it.
"Ow!"
said Strovgar, finally turning to acknowledge Julian.
"You loathsome pest! Can you not see that the adults are fighting?"
He reared up on his hind legs to bring his front paws down on Julian, and Stacy took the opportunity to leap onto his back. Unfortunately, Stacy leaped onto the wrong back, eliminating one more illusion and falling face first into the sand. Strovgar's claws tore down both sides of Julian's serape, tearing great gashes into it. It was painful and would definitely leave some red marks on his chest. He might have even lost a couple of hit points from the attack, but he wasn't scooping his intestines up off the ground like he'd expected.
"You're right," Julian called past Strovgar to Stacy. "He really does fight like a kitten."
Five, Strovgar snarled and took a wild swipe at Julian's head. He ducked it easily and jabbed away one more illusion. Strovgar's four remaining faces grimaced and groaned as Stacy stood up with Strovgar's blade dripping with Strovgar's blood, which had, judging by his expression, come once again from Strovgar's balls.
"Just kill him already," said Julian. "You don't need to keep attacking his junk."
Four Strovgars backed away from Julian and Stacy, tears welling up in their eyes. Tiny plants sprouted out of the sand where his testicle blood dripped.
"May the gods damn you both to the abyss!"
Julian was taken aback.
"Are you crying?"
Strovgar and his three illusory Strovgars made a sound between a roar and a wail as they turned and fled.
"Hey!" Stacy called out after him. "You forgot your dagger!"
She held it up by the blade, not so queasy about the nut blood as Julian had been, and hurled it at the fleeing Strovgars. It went right through one, which vanished. The three remaining Strovgars shrieked and continued running, not even bothering to stop and pick up his dagger.
"He's not getting away that easy," said Stacy.
She hopped on Julian's horse and whipped the reins.
"Yah!"
The horse obediently bolted after the Strovgars.
"Just let him go!" Julian called out after her. "He's not worth it!"
If Stacy heard him, she wasn't swayed. As the horse ran at full gallop, she leaned over, plucked Strovgar's dagger out of the sand, then sat upright again. Julian had to admit that was pretty impressive. Julian wouldn't shed any tears over Strovgar's death. Strovgar was a creep for sure, and the world would probably be a better place without him. But he didn't like watching Stacy chase down an unarmed person and slaughter them while they were fleeing. Besides, however vile Strovgar's intentions may have been, he hadn't succeeded with them, and he had certainly come away from the encounter worse off than Julian and Stacy combined. Under ideal circumstances, Strovgar might have been about just as fast as a horse, but his gait betrayed the pain in his nuts, and Stacy was quickly catching up with him. She leaned right, holding the curved dagger blade out as far as her arm could stretch, like she was going to do a drive-by knifing. Three Strovgars looked back at her.
"Please!"
they cried.
"Mercy of the gods, spare me!"
Stacy rode even harder until she was almost right on top of him, pulled her arm back to swing, then tumbled ass over face into the sand when the horse disappeared out from under her.
"Coward!"
she called out after Strovgar, hopping to her feet and kicking sand in his direction. Julian started walking northward again, giving Stacy some time to chill and Strovgar some time to keep fleeing before he summoned another horse. Whether her desire to murder him was justified or not, Julian was down to his last level one spell for the day and wanted to get as much distance out of it as possible.
"He said there's a village not far from here," said Stacy
when she finally caught up with Julian. Julian didn't know whether she had sufficiently chilled in that very small amount of time or whether she was intentionally bringing up a different subject because she didn't want to talk about it. Either was fine with him.
"Do you think he was telling the truth?"
Stacy shrugged.
"I can't see anything he'd have to gain by us believing that, and he had to come from somewhere."
Julian scanned ahead.
"I don't see any signs of, well, anything."
"We're bound to find it if we keep riding north. Conjure up another one of those horses."
"Okay," said Julian. "But this is my last one, so we can't afford to go running off on other errands."
He felt he was putting it diplomatically enough.
"I'm cool now. I gave him more than enough to remember me by. Hopefully he'll think twice before trying his tricks on someone else."
That was good enough for Julian. He pointed at the ground.
"Horse!"
Their transportation for the next couple of hours was taken care of. They rode for an hour or more, until the sun began to set on the featureless desert horizon. Julian peered ahead, squinting to make his eyes focus on the furthest point that they were capable of, but it didn't look any different to anything else he could see for. As if they'd just stepped through a dimensional rift, they were galloping through a cabbage patch. Dwarven farming folk were leaping out of their way as Julian's horse trampled their produce. there was a charming water wheel ahead and to the left of them, and a wooden footbridge across a...
Shit!
Cried Julian, pulling the reins too late as the horse ran off the edge of the ravine. His heart barely had time to stop beating before he realized the danger wasn't quite as great as it had first appeared. 5 feet down, they hit water. They hadn't even fallen off the horse's back. The magical beast of burden, even now, was diligently horse-paddling its way across the river.
"Where are we?" said Stacy. "Did we just teleport?"
"I don't think so. The air feels the same. We might have just stepped through a..."
"Gator!" cried Stacy.
"I was going to say facade or illusion, but if that's what people say down south, then whoa!"
Julian felt himself being grabbed by both upper arms and yanked to the left, Stacy's weight pulling him off the horse and into the water. He took a moment to orientate himself and found Stacy swimming underwater beside him. She pointed in the direction they'd just come from. Julian turned and saw his horse's brown legs paddling wildly. Then a massive set of reptilian jaws clamped down on its back and belly. The water turned blurry red, then the jaws snapped shut as the horse, its hit points drained to zero, winked out of existence.
"Damn it!"
Julian said in a burst of bubbles. Feeling a tug on his serape, he suddenly appreciated that he and Stacy were in a river with a giant hungry alligator which had just been cheated out of a meal. He swam in the other direction, but couldn't help but look back. The gator's massive snout poked through the murky pink cloud of dissipating horse blood. It was swimming right for him. There was no way he could outswim that thing. He'd had a good run, but this was it. He was going to. Stacy grabbed his wrist tightly and pulled him upward faster than any human being had any business swimming. Julian looked forward again and saw that Stacy had grabbed hold of one of the buckets on the water wheel. Julian grabbed the next bucket, and Stacy let go of his arm. As he was lifted out of the water, he gratefully took in a great breath of air and realized that he had a very short time to think about what action he might take before the wheel dumped him right back into the river and into the jaws of a just as hungry but more pissed off giant alligator.
"Jump!"
said Stacy. Julian turned just in time to see her leaping from the top of the wheel onto the footbridge. Near as it was, it wasn't so near that he had any prayer of making the same jump. Then again, there was always the chance he could roll a natural 20.
"Shit!"
he cried as he pushed himself away from the top of the wheel. Nope, not even close. His timing was off. He hadn't accounted for the added weight of his wet clothes, and he hadn't allotted any skill points to jump. He was fucked. He made a desperate grab for the edge of the bridge, but he was going to miss it by a mile. Then an upside-down Stacy filled his field of vision. She grabbed both of Julian's wrists, and there he was, suspended in the air by his arms. He looked up. Stacy was hanging upside down from the bridge with her legs locked on its railing. That was some quick thinking on her part, and an incredible feat of strength and dexterity. Looking down, he found that the giant alligator hadn't yet given up the hunt. Julian pulled his feet up just in time to avoid its snapping jaws.
"Stacy, help!"
Stacy grunted, and Julian felt himself ascend. Other hands grabbed his wrists, and he pulled himself up onto the relative safety of the bridge. He and Stacy lay on the bridge for a moment to catch their breaths. Julian sincerely hoped that the four friendly-looking dwarves who were staring down at them had no intentions to rape or murder them. They needed a bit of a break from that. A small round of applause broke out from the dwarven farmers watching from either side of the bridge. Julian assumed that was mostly for Stacy's acrobatics show.
"Good evening,"
said a plump male dwarf in brown overalls.
"He gave us quite a scare. We thought for sure you were going to feed old Edna for the night."
"Old Edna?"
said Julian.
"Is that what you call the giant alligator?"
"Crocodile,"
the dwarf corrected him. He smiled warmly and offered Julian a hand while a couple of other dwarves helped Stacy up.
"My name is Orgul. I'd like to welcome you to our little village. Tamar."
Chapter 38. It was just as well that Catherine's first voyage as captain was accompanying another ship. Being co-owner of the chicken hut had taught her little about leadership and absolutely nothing about sailing. It also didn't help that her entire crew was composed of people who had just been trying to murder her, and several of them probably resented her usurping what they felt was their rightful position. If they got a few minutes of privacy to chat amongst themselves, they might each make some concessions, come to an agreement, and regroup for a good old-fashioned mutiny, which Catherine, aided only by Butterbean and Randy, would have a difficult time putting down. Fortunately, enough of them had died or been wounded beyond the ability to work that the ones who were able to work had their hands too full tending to the short-handed ship to start up any conspiracies. But in case any of them decided to get chatty, Catherine sent Randy to mingle among them. Ostensibly, his assignment was to give a helping hand where it was needed, but she actually wanted a set of ears that were loyal to her, floating around to stop that sort of talk before it started. She just needed to stay in control for however long it took to get to whatever mystery island Captain Longfellow insisted they visit before heading to Baran.
"Do you know where we are headed?"
asked one of the new crewmen. It was the big, bald, black guy, one of the three who were sizing each other up for the position Catherine had pulled right out from under all of them. Catherine glanced down to make sure Butterbean was still standing next to her, then told herself it's not because this guy's black. She shook her head. "We're just following the other ship."
"Pardon me, Captain."
There was a hint of contempt in his voice.
"I do not ask because I do not know where we are headed. I ask because I do know where we are headed, and I thought you should know as well."
That sounded reasonable, if not a little foreboding. It couldn't hurt to start learning her way around.
"Spill your guts, then. Oh, where are we headed?"
He lifted his massive dark brown arm, covered from shoulder to wrist in even darker tattoos, and pointed out past the ship's bow.
"Do you see how the horizon is blurred over there?"
Catherine peered in the direction he was pointing. There did appear to be some kind of dark gray fog obscuring the line between the greenish-blue water and the cloudless sky, but it didn't seem alarmingly unusual to her.
"Yeah, I see it. Well, what about it?"
"Those are the shoals of mist."
He was looking at her like she should be impressed by that.
"Awesome."
The big man frowned.
"The shoals of mist must be avoided at all costs, and yet we sail straight for them."
"Why?" asked Catherine. "Well, what's so bad about them? Are there cannibals?"
"There may be once the shoals tear open our hulls. We have no food, no means of escape, and no hope of getting rescued. When the food stores have been consumed, and then the animals..."
He glanced down at Butterbean, then raised his eyes back to Catherine.
"With what else will we nourish ourselves but one another?"
Catherine couldn't help but feel some subtext in his words and the way he spoke them. "I'm almost looking forward to the shipwreck, which will lead to all our deaths, because at least I'll get to eat the bitch who stole my boat before I die."
"Thank you for the information."
Catherine pretended to not notice any subtext. If he wanted to threaten her, then he could go grow a sack and say what he had to say. Captain Longfellow had warned her that some of the crew might be apprehensive about where they were going, and that she should reassure them that they'd all be fine as long as they followed close behind the maiden's voyage.
"If you do as you're told, we'll nourish ourselves just fine."
She spoke loudly enough for other crew members to hear as well, both to reassure them and so that they might witness their new captain handling her shit when it came to implied insubordination.
"Stay on their tail. Do you understand?"
The crewman narrowed his eyes, looking left and right to see who else may have overheard. Catherine kept her eyes squarely focused on him. Finally, he gave her a slight bow.
"Very good, Captain."
She wasn't smug about her little victory. Now that she had made her point, she wanted him to know that while she may not be heeding this particular warning, she valued his insight.
"What's your name?"
"I am Atal."
"Thank you, Atal. This boat is smaller than the maiden's voyage. Anything that they can pass through should prove no problem for us. But maybe keep an anchor ready to drop so that we don't ram them if they should happen to hit a snag."
Atal nodded.
"Very good, Captain."
That time, although she was listening for it, Catherine didn't pick up any contempt in his voice. It wasn't like she had any great reason to have unwavering faith in Captain Longfellow. He was good for a laugh and a drink before turning in for the night, but he was no bumbling dandy like Captain Martinoli. Captain Longfellow clearly enjoyed the respect and admiration of his men, and he had perhaps more reason than any of the Nightwind's crewmen to think Catherine had swiped his rightfully captured ship out from under his nose. Had she accidentally insulted him in front of his whole crew? The more she thought about it now, she reasoned that he could be leading her into a trap. On the other hand, Captain Longfellow seemed like a straightforward sort, and more likely to call someone out to their face than to lead them into some kind of spooky mist trap. Judging from the little time she'd spent in his company, that didn't seem like his style. Catherine asked Atoll to instruct the guys working the sails to stay far enough behind the maiden's voyage so that they would have time to drop anchor if the need arose. As slow as it was traveling once they entered the mist, that precaution still had them practically right on top of each other. That was just as well, because Captain Longfellow had some things to shout at them.
"Stay close enough to see us,"
he bellowed to them through the fog.
"Keep ready at the rudder, and follow us exactly."
Atoll delegated responsibilities to the crewmen that Catherine felt bad for not understanding. She hadn't earned this position any more than Captain Martinoli had. They'd acquired it through two different means of fraud. On the other hand, Catherine didn't really give a shit about being a ship's captain. This was simply a means to get her to that ice woman's island, grab the magic gem of whatever, and get back to the mainland so she could get Tim resurrected. When all that was done, she might thank one of the men who had gone above and beyond the call of duty by handing over the reins and naming him captain. The fog got so thick that the maiden's voyage was completely obscured. They wouldn't have been able to continue following if not for a brightly lit lantern hanging from a hooked pole off the back deck.
"Perhaps I was mistaken," said Atoll,
about an hour into their excruciatingly slow journey of seemingly random sharp turns.
"Why?" asked Catherine. "Are we almost there?"
"I know not where there is. To the best of my knowledge, no ship has ever sailed this far into the shoals of mist. It is known only as a place for ships to die and sailors to go mad, and then also eventually die."
As more hours passed, Catherine's eyes and mind grew weary from the strain of trying to keep up with that lantern. Every time a particularly dense puff of fog blew by, completely obscuring it for a second, she worried that they might fall far enough behind that they wouldn't be able to see it again. She realized that she was putting blind faith in Captain Longfellow after all. He could cripple them any time he wanted simply by extinguishing the light in that lamp, leaving them stranded and helpless. Even as they followed the maiden's voyage to the best of their ability, she still felt scrapes and bumps as Night Wind's hull connected with underwater obstacles, hard enough to feel, but not quite hard enough to break through. But perhaps even more worrying were the non-stationary things that occasionally scraped against or bumped into Night Wind's hull. Finally, the path straightened out and the bumps and scrapes became less frequent.
"Lower your anchor!"
Captain Longfellow called through the fog.
"Shit!" said Catherine, as the back of the maiden's voyage became visible again.
"Boat! Ahoy! Steer!"
She sighed with relief when Nightwind veered left just in time to avoid a collision, then felt embarrassed about the orders she'd shouted. When the two ships were anchored alongside one another, Captain Longfellow instructed Catherine to count up the number of Nightwind's crewmen who were missing limbs, then choose three men to accompany her to the island. Randy was an easy enough choice. She also picked Denise, just so she could keep an eye on her and keep her from causing any trouble on the boat in Catherine's absence. She considered that Atoll was the strongest contender to lead a possible mutiny, and that it would be good to keep him away from the crew, but where would they go? Whatever means Captain Longfellow had at his disposal to navigate his way through the shoals of mist, he was keeping that knowledge to himself. In the end, she chose Atoll as the final member of Night Wind's envoy because he was the only one of them who she knew by name, and because she liked to think he was starting to warm up to her. Once Atoll had counted up the ship's maimed, Catherine, Butterbean, and the rest of her landing party climbed into Night Wind's single rowboat, and the crew lowered them into the fog-obscured water.
"It's not far now,"
said Captain Longfellow, as he and his landing party were lowered into the water.
"Just follow the sound of me voice."
Randy and Atoll took oar duty, quickly finding their rhythm and following the sound of Captain Longfellow belting out some song. It sounded like he was making up on the spot about pirates, dicks, butt sex, and seamen. If there was any subtextual meaning, it was lost on Catherine. Fortunately, Captain Longfellow wasn't wrong about almost being there. He'd only finished the third stanza of his song, which involved shoving things aside from his penis into other men's buttholes, when the fronts of their rowboats crunched against sand. Captain Longfellow stopped singing.
"How feels the land beneath your feet, Captain?"
Unable to see him, Catherine could only assume that he was talking to her. She stepped out of the rowboat in order to be able to give a more honest reply. She had to admit, it felt good. After a few days at sea, there was something nice about standing on something that wasn't swaying.
Wow! I don't remember it feeling so... solid.
Ha!
Barked Captain Longfellow.
Some captain you be!
Where are we?
Asked Atoll.
What island is this?
Captain Longfellow pulled the stopper out from a bottle of something and took a long, greedy swig, then belched.
Be damned if I know what it's called. 'Tis home to the strangest manner of folk ye ever set your eyes on.
Cannibals? Asked Catherine.
By the gods, I hope not. There's not that many of them to begin with.
Something that sounded like a heavy wooden crate thunked down in the sand not far from Catherine.
What's that? Asked Catherine.
A gift for the natives,
said Captain Longfellow.
Everyone grab a handle.
Catherine knelt next to the box and felt around until she found a metallic handle on the side. Everyone lifted it once, and she suddenly felt like a pallbearer.
Is it a dead body?
It is not, in fact,
said Captain Longfellow, his tone suggesting that he was a little put off by having to answer that question.
You have a strange fixation with cannibalism,
Atoll observed.
Did someone try to eat you when you were a child?
Catherine rolled her eyes, well aware that no one could see her.
No, it's just that... never mind.
They walked for hours, nearly blind in the thick fog. Catherine could barely make out the people around her. The casket-like box they were all carrying was the only thing that kept them from wandering away from each other and getting lost. The gods only knew how Captain Longfellow was navigating. A couple of hours later, Catherine's legs ached something fierce. She had hoped at the beginning of the trek that they were climbing to the top of a small hill and would soon enjoy a leisurely stroll down the other side, but it gradually became evident that the whole trip was going to be uphill. They were climbing a mountain. They took a couple of breaks to rest their legs and sip a drink, but nobody was too keen to hang around long. The novelty of the fog had worn off pretty quickly, and being blind sucked. Finally, when blindness started to seem preferable to the burn in her thigh muscles, the fog started to thin out. Catherine could see the people around her more clearly. She could see Butterbean and even make out the shapes of scrawny, leafless trees on either side of the path. Hell, she could even see the path now. It wasn't much of a sight, just hard-packed dirt with the occasional fog-choked weed struggling to survive, but it was still nice to be able to see. A few minutes later, her vision was completely restored. She hadn't realized just how blind she'd been until now that she could tell it was night. It made sense, considering how long they'd been walking, but it was kind of amazing that the fog was dense enough to block out her ability to tell day from night. A big, fat full moon illuminated the swirling blanket of fog that covered everything for miles around.
It's like we're on top of a cloud!
Captain Longfellow stopped the procession and motioned for them to set down the crate. He smiled at her.
Take a look behind ye!
Catherine turned around.
Holy shit!
A massive stone head was carved into the side of the mountain, some combination of man and cat vomiting out fog from its wide-open mouth.
The fuck is that?
Asked Denise. Captain Longfellow's crewmen smiled knowingly, no doubt remembering the first time they saw this. The captain himself simply shrugged.
Be damned if I know! I've not dared try to venture inside. It be the source of the fog, which keeps this place cut off from the rest of the world.
He winked.
Except, of course, for those who know how to find it.
How did you acquire this knowledge?
Asked Atoll.
By keeping me mouth closed and me ears open.
Atoll nodded, understanding and accepting that Captain Longfellow wasn't going to give up his secrets.
The Sombali people, are they real?
Captain Longfellow grinned wide, showing off his impressive collection of precious metal teeth.
See for yourself!
He turned to face forward and howled out some call that sounded like a wolf in heat. Catherine and Butterbean exchanged a glance. After a moment of silent anticipation, something rustled in the bushes ahead. A tiny hairy man, naked but for a thick coating of dry orange mud, emerged onto the path. He wasn't like Tim. He was the other kind of midget in the game, like Frank, a gnome.
Longfellow!
The gnome exclaimed happily, his arms wide open in a friendly greeting.
Longfellow!
Other gnomes called out from the wilderness, then ran out onto the path. Men, women, and children, all covered in cracked, dry mud, and not a one of them wearing a strip of clothing. The children reminded Catherine of Cabbage Patch Kids, but somehow managed to be both even uglier and more adorable. Captain Longfellow spread his arms out wide, mimicking the gesture all the gnomes were making. His crewmen quickly followed his example. After a brief exchange of glances, Catherine, Randy, Denise, and Atal did likewise. A few of the gnomes took a tentative step toward them, but stopped when Butterbean growled.
"Stay calm, Butterbean," said Catherine. "They're friendly."
She raised a brow at Captain Longfellow.
"They are friendly, right?"
"Ha!" said Captain Longfellow. "You don't know the meaning of the word."
Catherine wasn't sure what he meant by that, but he didn't seem afraid, so she assumed they must be friendly. Captain Longfellow turned to address the gnomes.
"Hola!"
Wide grins spread across their faces.
"Hola!"
They swarmed the visitors, placing their hands all over the visitors' bodies. While it certainly wouldn't fly back home, and would likely be deemed inappropriate in most parts of this world as well, to the best of Catherine's knowledge, it didn't have a sexual vibe to it. It was more like they were just curious, appreciating the texture of these giant strangers' exotic clothes.
"The fuck is going on here?" asked Denise.
Randy looked positively horrified.
"This is making me very uncomfortable,"
Denise scoffed.
"Cuh, well, I think this was like heaven for you. Bunch of kids grabbing at your pecker. It's probably hard as rock right now." "That ain't a nice thing to say,"
Randy scowled at Denise.
"I told you I ain't like that."
Catherine couldn't help but glance down at Randy's crotch. There was no noticeable bulge. They chattered excitedly in some gibberish language that Catherine didn't understand, but after listening for a moment, it wasn't completely gibberish. She could actually pick out a few words. "Are they speaking Spanish?" Catherine remembered the greeting Captain Longfellow and the gnomes had shouted at one another. They weren't saying hola. Well, Captain Longfellow might have been. It was clear that he didn't understand their language and had simply learned to mimic one sound that got them all riled up. But the gnomes were saying hola. She leaned toward Randy and Denise.
"Do either of you speak Spanish?"
Denise glared up at her.
"Do I look like a fucking boehner to you?"
"No, you look like a fucking asshole. Randy?"
Randy shook his head.
"Just a few words from high school."
Catherine tried to call back her own memories of high school Spanish. She cleared her throat.
Yo tengo.
She strained her brain, trying to think of a noun. Any noun.
Papas frites?
The gnomes stared up at her in silent awe, as did Captain Longfellow and his crewmen.
"Papas frites?"
cried one of the gnomes. Then they all crowded in on her, excitedly talking a mile a minute. But the only words Catherine could understand were papas frites.
"You can speak their language?"
asked Captain Longfellow. Catherine shrugged.
"Not really. I just said pretty much all I know."
"What did you say to them?"
"I told them I have French fries."
"What are French fries?"
"Fried potato sticks."
Captain Longfellow scrutinized her.
"Where did you get fried potato sticks?"
"I didn't," said Catherine. "Like I said, those are the only words I remember."
"Ye be a mysterious one indeed, Captain."
Catherine noticed that there was no sign of mockery in his voice when he called her Captain. She should probably keep working this mysterious foreigner angle. It was getting her some respect.
"Let me try one," said Randy.
"Donde está?"
He bit his lower lip in thoughtful concentration, then his eyes lit up.
"El baño,"
he finished triumphantly. The gnomes all stared up at him perplexedly. Then one of them pointed to a tree on the side of the path. Randy frowned.
"Well, I suppose that makes sense."
"What did you say?"
asked Captain Longfellow.
"I asked him where the bathroom is. Foreign languages weren't really my strong suit."
"Neither is your native language," Catherine refrained from saying. Randy regularly took enough abuse from Denise, and she didn't feel the need to pile any more on him.
"Be there nothing else ye can say to them?"
said Captain Longfellow. Catherine bit her lower lip.
"If we really put our minds together, we might be able to say, 'I have a bathroom,' and ask them where the French fries are."
Captain Longfellow sighed.
"Hey, not terribly useful."
He looked down at the naked gnomes.
"Gaston!"
The gnome who had first greeted them nodded.
Gaston!
Catherine tried to think of what the word Gaston might have meant in English, but she couldn't come up with anything. Judging by the look on Randy's face, he was trying to think the same thing and coming up with just as much for his effort. The gnomes disengaged and started walking further up the path.
Let's go,
said Captain Longfellow, bending down to grab the box handle nearest him. Everyone else followed suit, grabbing their own handles. They lifted the box and followed the crowd of what Catherine desperately tried to keep from thinking of as Mexican Ewoks. About 30 more minutes passed before the ground leveled out. They were high enough above the fog to give Catherine a tiny hint of vertigo. She knew in her head that a fall from where she stood would continue through the fog for a much longer distance, but she force-deluded herself to imagine the fog as a soft, pillow-like surface. Thankfully, the gnomes led them away from the edge and into the island's interior. It was less of a jungle wilderness than Catherine had expected, and more like a well-cultivated orchard. There were oranges, lemons, grapefruits, and other citrus varieties that she didn't recognize. Scurvy was certainly not high on the list of these people's problems. Beyond the orchards were vegetable gardens, sectioned off in squares with paths running grid-like among them. Now that the trees weren't obscuring her view, the moonlight was enough for her to make out the curve of the tree line on either side. She guessed that in the light of day, she would see that they composed a full outer ring and that the vegetable gardens formed a similarly concentric ring. After they passed the gardens, they walked through a series of pens which housed pigs, chickens, and some strange-looking reptilian livestock that Catherine didn't recognize and hoped she wouldn't be asked to eat. The next ring was a thick bamboo forest with some stalks growing as tall as 20 feet. Given the utilitarian nature of the outer rings, Catherine assumed that the Zumbali people needed to take advantage of every square inch of land they had. She was surprised that they let bamboo grow wild like this. Of course, it was useful for making the animal pens, but there was only so much of the stuff they needed for that. Even if they made their shelters with it, they couldn't possibly need this much of it. The adorably ugly children ran ahead, disappearing into the bamboo and shouting excitedly. When the bamboo cleared, Catherine saw the justification for them growing so goddamn much of it. Their entire village was made of the stuff. An outer perimeter of tiny houses gave way to a second ring of houses, which were just as tiny, but raised a level higher on thick stalks. These weren't simple huts either. There was complexity and beauty in their split-level design.
This is incredible, said Catherine. I wasn't expecting this level of sophistication.
She realized her praise might be mistaken for condescension and felt bad for voicing her assumptions aloud.
Huh, said Denise. So they built a couple of shacks out of sticks. Big deal. Look at them, running around, naked as the day they was born. Ain't nothing but a bunch of spear-chucking savages.
Catherine allowed herself to feel relatively better about her assumptions.
You'll find no spears here, dwarf. The Zumbali be completely peaceful. Since nobody knows how to find them, or that they even exist, they have no enemies, and I aim to keep it that way.
Well, la-dee-fucking-da! What the fuck are we even doing here? What's in this box that we had to lug it up a goddamn mountain to give it to a bunch of filthy peacenik fucking hippie midgets?
Captain Longfellow stopped the procession, lowered the box, and lifted the lid.
Hardtack and dried beef!
The children, as well as some of the more shameless young adults, swarmed them again. But this time, they didn't get all gropey and grab-assy. They were more interested in the same hard, tasteless biscuits and chewy strips of beef that the captain had been rationing out. They passed it around excitedly, but no one took so much as a single bite of it. Denise glared up at Captain Longfellow.
If you had all this food aboard the boat this whole time, then why was you being so stingy with it?
It wasn't for us.
Captain Longfellow gazed admirably at the gnomes.
It be for them. It was all I had on me the first time I met them. They thought it was the greatest thing in the world. For all they produce on the island, you'll notice there be no wheat nor cattle.
You'll notice I don't give a fuck, said Denise. Why'd we come so far out of our way to deliver snacks?
The Zumbali be a very religious people. From what I've been able to understand, they worship the god whose face be carved into the side of this very mountain, who puts out the fog which keeps them safe from the dangers of the outside world.
Denise sighed.
Ugh, well, maybe I'm making myself clear. I don't give a shriveled-up dog turd about their shitty island or their fog-puking god. What's in this for us?
The crowd of gnomes quieted. Those behind Captain Longfellow stepped to the left or right, leaving a clear aisle running between them. In the doorway of the hut at the end of the aisle stood a wild-haired gnome, older than any of the others by at least a couple of decades. His body was coated with the same dry orange mud as the rest of the gnomes, but his face was covered in blue mud.
"Longfellow,"
he said, spreading his arms wide and grinning. His teeth were silver and triangular, the top ones and bottom ones fitting together precisely like the teeth of a bear trap. Captain Longfellow returned the gesture.
"Gaston!"
Three or four of the older children ran up to the old gnome, apparently named Gaston, took a knee, and held up offerings of hardtack and beef jerky. Gaston accepted a bit of beef from one of the children, then waddled past them toward Captain Longfellow. Catherine caught one of Longfellow's crewmen eyeing her with some weird smile on his face. He looked away as soon as she spotted him. She thought he was just checking her out until she noticed two more of Longfellow's men giving Randy, Atal, and Denise the same look. It was conceivable that they might be checking out Randy and Atal, if that's what they were into. But Denise? Nobody was into that. Catherine made a mental note to keep aware of her surroundings in case these guys were up to something, but turned her attention back to Captain Longfellow and Gaston. The old gnome stopped before the captain and held his right hand forward. Captain Longfellow got down on one knee, bowed his head, took Gaston's hand in both of his, and gave it a gentle kiss on the wrist. Then he offered his own right hand to Gaston, who took it in both of his, opened his mouth wide, then bit down hard on Captain Longfellow's thumb.
"Jesus Christ!" shouted Catherine, paralyzed with horror at the sight of Captain Longfellow's blood flowing out of the mad old gnome's metal grin.
"Captain!"
cried Randy. Atal remained silent, but his eyes betrayed his terror.
"You was right, Catherine," said Denise. "They're a bunch of goddamn cannibals."
Catherine and Randy rushed forward, but two of Longfellow's men blocked their way. Were they in on this? Had they set their own captain up? Was this an unnecessarily complicated mutiny? Taking a second to reassess the situation, Catherine noticed that while Captain Longfellow was grimacing in pain, he wasn't making any move to defend himself or free his hand. She'd seen him fight on the rear deck of the Maiden's Voyage. He could hold his own against the biggest, sword-wielding badasses on the sea. Surely he could defend himself against one old gnome armed with nothing but a set of metal dentures. With a groan and a crunch, Gaston's teeth clamped together, and he pulled his head clear of Captain Longfellow's thumbless right hand. He tilted his head back, his face completely slathered in the captain's fresh blood, then spit the thumb high into the air. When it landed on the ground with a soft thud, the crowd of gnomes cheered. Much to Catherine's surprise, Captain Longfellow's men cheered right along with them.
"What the ever-loving fuck is going on here?"
asked Denise. Catherine had to admit that she was wondering the same thing. Gaston regarded Captain Longfellow, who remained kneeling but looked like he might fall over any second, then turned back toward the house he'd emerged from and shouted a few words. Another blue-faced gnome ran out of the house with a fist-sized hermit crab shell spewing white vapor, not unlike the fog which blanketed the island and surrounding shoals. He ran past Gaston and offered Captain Longfellow the shell. Maintaining as much grace as he was capable of, Captain Longfellow accepted the shell, gave the blue-faced gnome a slight bow, then guzzled back whatever was in it. Dark purple liquid ran down his cheeks and chin as he greedily gulped down as much as he could take. Gaston's assistant stood close by the captain, holding his hands below the shell as if he expected him to drop it. Captain Longfellow didn't disappoint, dropping the shell right into his hands and collapsing to the ground, writhing in pain. Catherine didn't know what to do. She hated to just stand around while the situation kept going from bad to worse, but this all appeared to be part of some ritual which Captain Longfellow was knowingly and voluntarily taking part in.
"Is he okay?"
She felt stupid for asking the question, as he was clearly not. Nobody bothered responding. Those in the know simply stared, like watching a man die an agonizing death right before their eyes was the most natural thing in the world. Catherine, Randy, Atal, and Denise simply stared in horror and morbid curiosity. Finally, the captain stopped groaning and squirming. Catherine hoped that at least his spirit was at rest.
"Sons of Seors," he said between gasps. "That never gets any easier."
He slowly rose on his left arm and wobbly legs, keeping his maimed right hand tucked under his blood-smeared shirt. When he finally got steady on his feet, he raised his right hand, showing off an inexplicably healthy thumb.
"Hola!
Hola!"
The gnome shouted in return. The children thought that was hysterical, laughing until tears streamed down the side of their faces. Catherine stared at the ground. This was no illusion or sleight-of-hand trickery. There was still a savagely removed human thumb lying on the ground in front of Gaston. There was still Captain Longfellow's blood smeared all over the crazy old gnome's face. Captain Longfellow held his re-thumbed hand down to the apprentice, who returned the shell to him. He turned to Denise, holding up the shell.
"This, dwarf, be what's in it for us."
Chapter 39. The noise had subsided, but the damage was already done. Ravenous was awake from his nap and couldn't get back to sleep. After a long, deep yawn, he wondered why the sled wasn't moving. Had they reached their destination? Maybe they were taking a break to eat. He was starving. Those shadow monsters had wiped out or driven away every animal in the forest. There were no rotting deer carcasses, no maggot-riddled squirrel corpses, not so much as a grub. He wasn't sure how much more of Chaz and Cooper's food he could stomach before he lost control and gobbled up one of the boar's eyes. The only reason he hadn't done so already was because that would only prolong the time they had to spend apart from Julian. Still, there was only so much temptation a bird could withstand. He grumpily squirmed his way out of Chaz's bag, and his heart nearly stopped when he discovered what caused all the noise that had woken him up. Chaz lay still on the ground next to the sled with three arrows sticking out of his back. His mouth and eyes were wide open, the latter looking delicious. Ravenous felt his gizzard grinding as he considered the ramifications of eating just one eye. If Chaz was dead, he didn't really need his eyes, but if he was alive, removing his eye might do him in. Ravenous was no doctor, but Chaz looked pretty dead to him. No, stop. He ruffled his feathers, shook the thought out of his head, and took in the rest of the scene. Cooper lay face down at the edge of some pool, with more arrows sticking out of him than Ravenous could bother to count. The satyr and some elf Ravenous hadn't ever seen before were in similar condition. The pixies were conspicuously absent. Ravenous supposed they could merely be invisible, but it seemed unlikely that they wouldn't be responding to their traveling companion's current predicament. Ravenous gasped. Had they been behind it? Those butterfly-winged freaks! He should have known better than to trust them. Still, it was odd that they'd leave behind their sled and... boar! If the boar had been shot, the question of whether or not to eat their eyes posed less of an ethical conundrum than the question of whether or not to eat Julian's friend's eyes. He checked the front of the sled and found that the boar were missing.
Shit!
This was silly. Why should Ravenous starve himself to preserve a couple of dead bodies? It wasn't as if they were going to remain in pristine condition out here in the wilderness in the time it would take for him to find Julian and lead him back here. He decided to give Cooper, Chaz, and the other mammals a little while to show some sign of being alive before he confirmed them dead. An hour seemed fair. In the meantime, he needed something to distract himself from thinking about eating their eyes. There were a couple of bags on the sled. Ravenous didn't hold out much hope that they would contain anything decent to eat, but it wouldn't hurt to take a peek. The buckle holding the bag closed proved too complicated for him to unfasten with his talon, but the strap it was connected to was easy enough to shred. When he finished tearing the strap, he lifted the top flap of the bag with his beak. The lack of aged raw meat couldn't really be considered a disappointment because he hadn't expected to find any. All he did find was a few of those little fluid pouches like the one that the pixie woman had forced him to drink from. It hadn't been as bad as he thought it would be, but neither was it what he wanted to fill his belly with. Then a thought occurred to him. If he could pour one of these down Chaz or Cooper's throat, he'd be able to definitively tell whether or not they were genuinely dead. The question of which person to test first was easy enough to answer. Ravenous would never be able to flip Cooper's massive body over. Chaz was already on his back with his mouth wide open. The real challenge was figuring out how to feed him the liquid. He knew from his experience with the bag's buckle that he didn't have any hope of opening these containers as they were meant to be opened. He'd have to tear